Welcome to our MOAS podcast. Today we are speaking with Lord Alf Dubs about safe and legal routes. He was one of the Czech children rescued from the Nazi regime by Kindertransport and has since been a dedicated campaigner for refugee and asylum seeker rights. Over the course of his long career in public service and advocacy, his dedication to the field of migration and promotion of safe and legal routes has resonated across government policy and advocacy campaigns in the UK. He continues to galvanise support for asylum seekers, refugees and unaccompanied child minors who are currently being neglected by government policy. MOAS is absolutely honoured today to speak with Lord Dubs about safe and legal routes. So I am so delighted today to speak with you about your experience and your expertise on migration and safe and legal routes. You have been instrumental in campaigning for refugee support and of course supporting sponsoring the amendment to the government's immigration bill in 2016, which has led to over 3,000 unaccompanied minors being able to access support in the UK. Now, as the pendulum of public opinion seems to shift increasingly to the right in terms of migration, it will be a pleasure today to speak with you about what needs to be done to advocate for refugee rights and safe migration pathways. So we'll jump straight in with the first question. Could you give us here at MOAS and the listeners a brief overview of your story and in particular your journey within the field of migration?
That could take about an hour. Okay, well, I came to Britain on a Kindertransport from Prague in July 1939. So I came as an unaccompanied child, a child refugee. My father was Jewish, my mother wasn't. And so he left when the Germans occupied Prague in March 1939. And my mother was refused permission to leave, so she got me on a Kindertransport. Before that, we had to, the German occupation meant we had to tear a picture of the Czech president Beneš out of our school books, put in a picture of Hitler, and so on. Anyway, my mother saw me off at Prague station, German soldiers with swastikas in the background, parents anxious, because they didn't know whether they'd see their children again. And off the train went, maybe there were 150 of us on that train. Took 2 days to get to the UK. When we got to the Dutch border after 24 hours, the older ones cheered because they knew they were out of reach of the Nazis. So as far as I was concerned, it was significant, but I didn't really understand why. And I was looking, I was on the lookout for windmills and wooden shoes, which is what I knew about Holland. Anyway, so we got to the Hook of Holland, then Harwich, and then to Liverpool Street. Now, I was about the youngest on the train. As I said, I was six. But I was also lucky because I think probably over half did not have a family member to meet them, whereas my father was there waiting for me at Liverpool Street Station. So that was the journey to the UK.
And in terms of your actual experience within the field of migration, as previous chief executive of the Refugee Council, your organisation was asked to facilitate the resettlement of Bosnian people who'd been persecuted in Serbian concentration camps. And I was wondering if such schemes then created the same sort of toxicity and kind of xenophobic narratives, which are very palpable today. And if not, what do you think are some of the contributing factors as to why public opinions have shifted today?
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting question. When I was the Refugee Council, we and the Red Cross together were asked at fairly short notice to arrange reception facilities for several thousand Bosnians from the Serb concentration camps. And we were waiting, there was a big day at Stansted Airport when they arrived and half the world's media were there. I had to prevent the media from having easy access, except to those that wanted to talk. One's experience with refugees, people have been through terrible experiences, and some of them want to talk to help get over it. Others don't want to talk about it at all, or maybe never, maybe not till later. Anyway, there was not much opposition to it, even though we had to move very, very fast. Partly it was a government scheme, it was a Home Office scheme, so that nobody could accuse me of being anti a government scheme that I agreed with. So we had that on our side. I think there was some resistance, but it was some local resistance, mainly because they said, oh, this won't work in our area. because we've set up reception centres in various parts of the country. But I think on the whole, it worked pretty well. One of the things we did in Newcastle, where we had a sort of a focus, was, and these were families, adults, which families, children or adults. One of the things that we did was my idea, but somebody in the Refugee Council thought of it, and I was there. We had an open day in Newcastle, where we welcomed to that open day to meet the refugees. We welcomed local councillors. We welcomed social workers, doctors, teachers, police, the whole volunteer organisation, the whole community. And I think that probably was helpful, because it meant that they had some ownership of the scheme in their locality. And I think that helped. But on the whole, the national position was not as hostile as it became later to other refugees. I think partly, and this is my own personal explanation only, partly there were some photographs showing those terrible Serb concentration camps with emaciated people who looked like they were in Belsen, emaciated people standing there. And I think people said, if they've been through that, we've got to welcome them. And I suppose the other reason was there was a definite number set by the government, so it wasn't an open-ended commitment. But I think the main thing was people knew what from television what these refugees had been through, and therefore were less likely to be hostile.
Yeah. And what do you think can be done to kind of combat those narratives, which are very obvious in the media and sometimes government policy today, which increasingly criminalise asylum seekers and refugees? In a practical sense, what do you think we can do as NGOs, as people, to try and combat those?
Well, there are a few things, I suppose. I can only tell you from sort of things we've tried to do. First of all, I always say, whenever we say anything or do anything, we've got to bear in mind that public opinion is what we have to persuade. The reason why the legislation, the amendment went through, was because public opinion began to be alert to this. So one of the things that helped was the same as helped with the Bosnians, namely, it was a terrible story, of course, the shocking pictures of people drowning in the Mediterranean, of a little Syrian boy, Alan Kurdi, drowned on a Mediterranean beach. So I think all those things, the public opinion on our side helped. Another thing is, I think we always have to explain what it is people have fled from. War, persecution. I mean, I always talk about a Syrian boy who said he'd seen his father blown up in front of him by a bomb in Aleppo and Damascus. And I think one has to say what it is that they're escaping from, and why it is that we should be humane, humanitarian in welcoming them. If people just say, oh, they only out for a better life, there's nothing wrong with wanting a better life at all, ever. But it doesn't make them refugees under the 51 Geneva Convention. But these, we have to say to our public opinion, this is what they've been through. These are the terrible experiences. They've suffered appallingly, no fault of their own. And can we give them a bit of safety and comfort and family love and so on? So these things all help. The other thing I think is at a local level to try and have events which involve them, you know, whether it's sport or anything else which involve them with local people, with local children and so on. So that, I hate this word normalized, but I think the trouble is people tend to see refugees almost as museum exhibits sometimes. And essentially, they're ordinary human beings and want to lead the sort of life that most other people want to live. And so the more one can normalize them through sport, locally here, there's an organization, and they have once a week, they have a refugee day. And different refugee groups provide food and the English classes and so on. So these are all events, but they're to help them. But the key thing is really to normalize them and to make sure that the local communities are welcoming, and at schools and so on. So there's a whole range of things one can do. And as I believe a lot of it can be done by local communities.
Yeah, definitely. I think particularly at the moment, we're trying to focus with our Safe and Legal Routes campaign on like educating people on who is an asylum seeker, who is a refugee and things, because in the media a lot you see, and from government policy, a lot of talk about asylum shopping, and it's
it's getting back to the root of why people are leaving the countries they're coming from as well, and educating people about why people leave, because like you said, that's what people need to know.
On the other hand, if I can just link that to your earlier question, when the Bosnians came, the government wanted them to come. The government had said they're going to do it. They asked two organizations to help, and we could always claim we had full government support. Today, we have government opposition. Mm-hmm. Today, we have government ministers, and I'm afraid this is true of many European countries, where government ministers send out negative signals. And if government ministers, community leaders, important people, if they all, well, community leaders don't send out negative signals, but government ministers do, and if they say we're trying to cut down the numbers and we don't want them here, then that sends a signal to local communities to be hostile. So I think the least we can expect is that government leaders, important people in our countries, should actually send out more positive messages, not hostile messages.
Yeah, exactly. And that kind of leads on to my next question. So with the Dubs Amendment, which was implemented in 2016, it was such a vital component of the immigration bill. But I was wondering how the amendment was actually implemented, and at the time, the kind of response you had from government and the public, and how do you think it has guided the way for safe migration pathways, hopefully in the future?
Well, that's quite a complicated question. Look, without going into too much detail, which would take a long time, what happened was that we learned at the time that this was 2016, as you say, that there were 95, according to Save the Children, there were 95,000 unaccompanied child refugees somewhere in Europe. Shocking figure. And according to Interpol, 10,000 of them had actually disappeared. Terrible. One child disappearing in our countries, everybody goes looking, searching desperately. And here we had 10,000 disappeared. So I put down this amendment. The government didn't like it. Theresa May, who was then the Home Secretary, invited me to see her. And she said she'd like me to withdraw the amendment. And I said, why? And she said, well, if we take these children, others will follow. And I said, but we can't turn our backs on young people who are sleeping in the jungle in Calais or on Greek islands or elsewhere around the Mediterranean. We can't turn our backs on them. They are vulnerable to trafficking, to criminality, prostitution, drugs, all sorts of things. So we parted company. Anyway, to cut a long story short, the amendment was passed by a big majority in the Lords, was defeated slightly in the Commons, went back to the Lords. And while this was going on, the media suddenly woke up to it. And as I mentioned earlier, there were these terrible photographs of people drowning in the Mediterranean, of Alan Kurdi, the Syrian boy, drowned on the Mediterranean beach. And public opinion began to wake up. And local groups were set up saying to welcome refugees in local areas. Wandsworth welcomes refugees, or Lambeth welcomes refugees. And I think that set a bit of a tone. So Theresa May, still Home Secretary, summoned me in again and said the government proposed to accept the amendment. Now, I think that was the weight of public opinion brought to bear in local constituencies on government supporting MPs. I've always said we must not make this a party political thing. The cause of child refugees should go across the political spectrum. But of course, we've had fewer Conservatives than we've had other parties supporting us. And I think the local pressure was exerted on MPs, and the government then felt they might lose the amendment, so they gave way. Now initially the amendment had a figure of 3,000, which was very small, actually, but that was, we had to discuss what was doable and what we get through. Anyway, for various technical parliamentary reasons, we had to drop the figure of 3,000 and have it open-ended. And the government then said after a while, they proposed to limit the number to 480. And I said, why? And they said there aren't enough local authorities providing foster families to accommodate the children. The model is if they're up to 16, they would be accommodated by foster families, the model in the UK. And so we challenged this and said we can find lots of local authorities. We quickly did a survey and we found 1,600 places, but the government insisted they had to keep that number down. Now there was a further amendment, which was to do with the Dublin Treaty, under which a refugee child in one EU country could apply to join a family in another. So a Syrian boy in France could apply to join an uncle or brother in the UK. Now, the problem was that when Britain, leaving the disastrous move to leave the EU, the amendment to another bill, which I got through, was to say that Britain should negotiate to continue the terms of the Dublin Treaty even after we left the EU. That's to say, the family reunion terms. And this passed in 2017. And then the government had another immigration bill. They keep coming. And they knocked that out. And they knocked it out. And that's a disaster because there's now no proper route. The government say there is one, but there isn't. There's no proper legal route for family reunion either. I tried earlier this year to get an amendment through. It didn't work. The government have a bigger majority now than they had some years ago. So we're going to try again. There's another bill going through Parliament called the Borders Bill, and we're going to do our best to amend it to see if we can safeguard the position, particularly for family reunion, because there are more of those, I think, than there are the ones who don't have any family here. So that's the position, and we shall go on doing it. We shall go on challenging the government, and the best way to do it is to move amendments to govern legislation to protect the rights of children to come here.
And how can the general public and NGOs alike advocate for unaccompanied minors to be supported in this way?
Well, I always say that the members of the public should let their voice be heard. That's to say, they should talk to their members of parliament. They should talk to local councillors. Faith groups can be very important. And any other organisations of which people are members, whether it's trade unions or businesses and so on, they're all ones where they should let their voice be heard, and it should be a welcoming voice. So that's important. And of course, at a local level, with local councillors, it matters a great deal. Because at local level, one's voice can be heard, and somehow it may have more of a resonance if it's linked to kids coming to local schools and so on. So yes, I think that is a crucial thing, that those of us who believe what we believe in should let our voices be heard, and let other people know that this is what we believe, and we believe these are the right policies for our countries to follow.
And I guess that kind of leads on to the final question, more broadly about safe and legal routes for any asylum seekers. Now, MOAS was the first NGO to run search and rescue actually in the Mediterranean. And since we've focused on running a campaign for safe and legal routes, so now we're focusing on educating people on what safe and legal routes can look like, and then also advocating for their implementation. But I was wondering in how you think we could generate cooperation among EU member states, because obviously that's the ideal, but how we can actually try and generate that cooperation. And in an ideal world, what safe and legal routes would look like for asylum seekers?
Okay, well let's do the first question first. Look, all I can do, along with other people, is to argue wherever we can. Unfortunately, the UK not being in the EU, our influence with other European countries is less, much less, even though I've always argued that this should be Europe-wide, not just an EU thing. It should go beyond the EU countries to other European countries. So one of the tragedies was that because a lot of the burden was on some countries only, like Germany, that the extreme right-wing political parties exploited that very cynically, which is another argument why public opinion must keep public opinion on our side, because the extreme right-wing parties have had a damaging effect on the politics of their countries, whether it's France or Italy or Hungary, they're always like that, and Germany and so on. So we've got to try and get the maximum international cooperation, and that undermines the extreme right-wing parties who campaign on total opposition to refugees anyway. So I think we should use every international forum possible. For example, I've been involved in, I'm a member of the OSCE Parliamentary Assembly Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. I'm on their Migration Committee. We've argued this there. We've had joint meetings with the Council of Europe where we've argued this. And we have to make it a key political demand that European countries should work together, share responsibility. Well, I think we would work together with UNHCR and the International Organization for Migration to see what the scale, what the volume of arrivals is and how we can share them across different countries. We should have to assess that they are refugees, not just economic migrants. It wouldn't work if As I repeat, there's nothing wrong with being an economic migrant, but that's up to each country individually to say, look, this is how many we like to take and our workforce needs and so on and so forth. And that's important. I'm not belittling it. But if we're talking about refugees, I think one possible model is the one I mentioned, is to get a cooperation between UNHCR and one or two other international organizations and see if we can work out what the numbers are, likely to arrival, likely pressure is, and then how we can transfer them from one EU country to the other, so as to share responsibility. So we would be saying to Greece, you know, we want to help you, and you've got so many people, and we give priority to the most vulnerable, so many people who are qualified to be refugees, say on Lesbos and Samos and so on, and then 800 will come to the UK and so and so, and 800 to France and 400 to Spain and something like that. We should do it. Now, it may be I'm too idealistic, but I still believe the world could cooperate in this way, and that's what I'd like to see.
Yeah, and I hope if we continue to advocate for this and galvanise communities, this will be a possibility.
Well, okay, I mean, we have to keep saying it. We have to keep saying when people say we can't handle all these people in the UK, I say, well, nobody's asking us to. We should share responsibility with other countries, but we're not taking our share. We're taking fewer than most other countries. When they moan about the people coming across the channel, I hate those cross-channel dinghies because they are people are being exploited and they are very, very dangerous. People should come back on safe and legal routes. So I hate the idea that people are being exploited and coming on dinghies. Well, in previous years, they came on the back of lorries, but whichever way, I hate the legal routes. They are dangerous, they are humiliating, and they're exploitative. And what we have to do is to have agreement about having safe and legal routes. And I was on a parliamentary committee, British Parliament, and we were looking at people coming across the Mediterranean. At that time, what was it called? Operation Sophia, I think. And that was intended to catch the traffickers. Well, it didn't. It saved lives. It didn't catch the traffickers. Because unfortunately, the traffickers, you know this, the traffickers, particularly in Libya, simply push the boats so many miles outside our territorial waters and then phone up the Western neighbors and they'll pick them up. So that was stopped, the boats. And then there were various arrangements made with Libya. And as you know, those the refugees who get to Libya are exploited and eventually held as slaves in some of the camps in Libya, unless they can pay the traffickers to take them across the Mediterranean. So yeah. It's a very nasty situation. And obviously, we've got to do everything we can to try and stabilize the situation in Libya. Whether that's working or not at the moment, I'm not sure, but it's been a terrible, terribly difficult situation there.
Yeah, definitely. But that's all my questions today. So thank you so much for taking the time to talk through them with me. Your insight's been amazing. And I've learned a lot, and I hope the listeners will learn a lot too.
Well, thank you for saying that. Look, it's still... there's one message, and a lot of us put it over. I get the publicity, but don't forget there are a lot of people doing good work. And it's wrong I get the publicity, but that's the way the media operate. There are a lot of good people there working. And there's some, can I just add to this, there's some fantastic volunteers working in the camps. You know, young people give up a year or two of their lives to help the even more vulnerable fellow young people. And the conditions in what was the jungle in Calais and what is now no longer the jungle, conditions there are very bad. They're very bad on the Greek islands, and these young people are fantastic, and they deserve all the medals, as do all the NGOs who work with refugees, who do a fantastic job. And it's been very privileged and lucky for me to be able to meet people like you.
It was an absolute pleasure speaking to Lord Dubs today. Please check out the MOAS website and socials for more information about safe and legal routes and about how you can get involved with the campaign.